Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Open Market Committee gave investors and many economists every last thing they wanted today. A half a point cut in its main interest rate, the federal funds rate. A half a point cut in another key banking rate, the discount rate. A statement that said in almost so many words, it'll cut more if it has to. So who knew that Ben Bernanke was so easy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Tuesday, the 18th of September. Great to have you here. Well, it took 4 years, 2 months, and 23 days, but who's counting? The Federal Reserve finally saw fit to cut interest rates today. That fact itself isn't really so surprising, given the summer we had with the liquidity crunch and all. What really caught people unawares, though, was what rates the Fed cut and by how much. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
The federal funds rate is the interest rate banks charge each other on overnight loans. The discount rate is what banks pay on short-term loans from the Federal Reserve. By slashing both, the Fed hopes to stave off any damage to the economy from the recent market turmoil. Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at Forecaster Global Insight. He says employment is slowing and consumer confidence is getting shaky. Today's report that wholesale prices fell last month gave the Fed even more reason to cut.
I think there's no question that the balance of risks has shifted from inflation to recession. All of a sudden, the risks of the downside became much, much greater.
Analysts were surprised. Brian Gendreau is a strategist with ING Investment Management. He expected to see a smaller rate cut with hints of more to come. Instead, he says the Fed's statement suggested investors shouldn't count on further interest rate cuts.
The way I read that is that what they will do is they will take these cuts back. In the future, they're going to take a wait-and-see attitude, and they're going to react to the data as it comes out.
Even so, Wall Street cheered the Fed's move. The Dow jumped 200 points within minutes of the announcement. But not everyone is celebrating. James Swanson of MFS Investments says the low cost of borrowing is what got us into this whole mess.
And to suddenly lower it and not let these financial institutions that made these imprudent decisions feel the pain, I wouldn't call it a bailout. I would call it a temporary fix.
And it won't solve troubles in the housing market, Swanson says. He says the interest rates on about 60% of subprime loans will reset in the next 2 years, from 5 or 6% to 8 or 9%. He says a half-point cut in short-term interest rates won't help those borrowers. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There were some trickle-down economics out of today's rate cut, and they all happened pretty quickly, as in just minutes after the Fed made its announcement. Banks cut what's called the prime rate. That's the one that'll eventually trickle down to you and me and our car loans and our credit cards. It's at 7.75% as of the moment. Also, the dollar tumbled pretty much right away, down to an all-time low against the euro, $1.40 or so, which means imports will eventually be getting more expensive. The president's nominee for attorney general, Michael Mukasey, is best known as a federal judge. But for the past year, he's been in private practice at a New York law firm where he helped pick up new clients needing white-collar criminal defense, say subprime lenders who might have run afoul of the law. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Mukasey's law firm, Patterson Belknap, began trying to drum up business from the subprime mortgage industry this July. A press release boasted, if there were allegations of criminal wrongdoing, Michael B. Mukasey and the firm's white-collar criminal defense team was uniquely qualified to help.
It is an unseemly association.
NYU professor Paul Light is an expert in the presidential appointment process. He says any link with the subprime mess doesn't help Mukasey.
It is a problem in the sense that this is very high in the headlines right now, and it has caused great disruption in the financial markets.
Mukasey couldn't be reached for comment, and his firm declined to make his clients' names public. But legal ethics experts say that's not surprising. Even revealing a client's name could tip off government investigators and violate attorney-client privilege. John Steele teaches legal ethics at UC Berkeley.
To reveal that to the government as you move into a government job would really inflict serious damage on your client. It's something that lawyers can't do.
Georgetown University law professor Paul Rothstein says Mukasey may have to quietly recuse himself from cases he's handled in private practice that haven't yet become public.
This is the hardest question in all of legal ethics, how an attorney can take himself off of a case without revealing something bad about his client.
But Paul Light thinks there's a simpler solution.
He doesn't have to name names. What he has to do is name subjects.
Light says he's sure those subjects will be explored at the Senate confirmation hearings. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Here it is, only Tuesday, and it feels like there's been a week's worth of news from big media companies already. Time Warner CEO Richard Parsons said today he's going to take a hard look at whether or not it makes sense to sell off his struggling internet company, AOL. We learned late last night the New York Times has given up on making people pay to read some of its content online. And Rupert Murdoch's News Corp says it's figured out how to customize ads on its internet company, MySpace. We asked Marketplace's Lisa Napoli to find the common thread here.
MySpace is a place where millions of people bare their souls, not to mention what kinds of things they like and dislike. That makes it a potential bonanza for marketers who can easily figure out how to sell what to whom. Now, they haven't done that on the social networking site until now, but News Corp is saying that this week it'll unveil technology so they can. University of Southern California marketing professor Ken Wilber says it's about time. After all, he says, News Corp didn't pay $770 million for MySpace a couple years ago for nothing.
For years, every time I go on MySpace, I see ads for dating services, but I'm a happily married guy. So I would love to see ads for things that I might be interested in, like what movies are coming out this weekend.
USC's Wilber says with online advertising growing 26% this year over last, it's obvious why big deal media companies like News Corp and AOL's Time Warner would be scrambling to figure out how to make a buck. And the beauty of the internet is that it allows you to customize in ways that haven't been possible before. That efficiency spooks people like Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy.
It's a very powerful and intrusive system. You're talking about the continual collection of personal information, but we have to have some basic rules.
Chester says the rules are just playing themselves out as the online medium matures and people are able to do more on the internet, like watch video. He says one thing seems conclusive from the failed New York Times attempt to charge for some of its content. People want what they get online to be free. They'll just have to wade through the ads now in order to get it. I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Yes, it will indeed be the happy music when we get there. Maybe even the really happy music. But just to keep everything in perspective, think about this for a second. Crude oil is up 34% so far this year. I'm just saying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Washington tomorrow, a House committee takes up Chinese imports. The topic is one you can probably guess, whether those products are safe or not. Not too long ago, all the talk was about something called the China price, multinational firms shifting production from countries with clear laws and tough regulations to countries with neither, but where production costs were lower. Commentator and economist Arthur Krober says now there should be a real price to pay.
Thanks to globalization, 21st century consumers can buy low-priced products made in places with 19th century conditions. But who drives this process? It's hardly the Chinese. The people who hold power in the production chain are the ones who control final distribution in the U.S. and Europe. They are the multinational owners of brands and the distributors, especially big-box retailers like Walmart, Best Buy, and Toys R Us. These firms earn at least 75% of the total profit in the sale of each can of pet food or Barbie doll. They have the power to dictate that their suppliers cut their prices every year or risk losing their business. China-based suppliers, operating on wafer-thin profit margins, have little choice but to do whatever they can to comply. The Chinese government, with just a few hundred product safety officials to oversee more than 300,000 industrial companies, is little more than a bystander. Ultimately, the multinationals that set the terms for the global production chain are the ones responsible for keeping it safe. Rich country governments must hold these companies accountable by enforcing strict product quality standards. And consumers should remember that they benefit enormously from the vast majority of Chinese exports that are cheap, reliable, and safe, things like iPods, cell phones, and laptops. Instead of panicking about goods from China, they should vote for politicians who will adequately fund product safety regulators, not starve them like the present administration. Multinational firms control the global production chain, and rich country consumers and governments benefit immensely from it. If we want China to clean up its own regulatory act, we should lead by example.
Arthur Krober is a principal in the Beijing-based economic research firm Dragonomics. Send us your thoughts on today's commentary or on anything else at all you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Fortune magazine has its 500 biggest companies in the world. Forbes has its 400 richest people in the world. London, England has more foreign billionaires than any place else in the world. More than a dozen of the world's richest tycoons live in the British capital. Russian oligarchs, Saudi princes, Asian entrepreneurs, and the occasional Greek shipping magnate. Why, you ask? Well, surely not because of the climate or the cuisine. No, the real reason, it seems, is taxes, or the lack thereof. The foreign-born super-rich in the UK pony up less to the government there than they would in any other large developed country. But it's a tax break that's fostering some resentment among less affluent Brits. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Foreigners who come to live in Britain face a simple question from the taxman.
Where's your real home? What's your real dwelling? Where do you really belong to?
The question is crucial, says tax accountant Francesca Lagerberg. Tell the UK taxman that your real home, your domicile, is abroad, and he won't touch a penny of what you own or earn overseas.
If you can keep items offshore, you're only taxed if you bring them into the UK. If you're not domiciled in the United Kingdom, it's a fantastically useful tax concept.
The concept isn't new. In the 1960s, when the Beatles were singing ruefully about the high level of tax they were paying, that famous American skinflint J. Paul Getty was living here and reportedly paying very little to the taxman. He was a non-domiciled resident. Today, a dozen billionaires and thousands of other very rich people enjoy the same status.
This is becoming a growing national scandal in the UK.
Labour union official Adam Lent.
People are noticing that those who are very wealthy, or the super rich, as they're becoming called in the UK, have very different rules applied to them around tax.
Lent represents the British equivalent of the AFL-CIO. Delegates at the annual conference have just demanded the abolition of the non-domicile rule. Applications are not double-checked. It costs the UK $8 billion a year, and it's unfair.
Most people find this absolutely remarkable, that these people can be living here every single day of the year for decades, enjoying the benefits of living in the UK and living in London, but not paying their fair share of tax as they would in most other advanced economies, as they would in America, for example.
But the non-domicile tax rule has many defenders, like Tim Congdon of Lombard Street Research.
Does Britain gain or lose from having these non-domiciled rich people here?
The answer, he says, is obvious.
They set up businesses, they pay hotel bills, they pay plane fares, and so on. And this all benefits the British economy, particularly, of course, the economy of London and the South East.
If the non-domicile rule were scrapped, he says, thousands of wealthy foreigners would leave. Adam Lent concedes the odd Russian oligarch might go, but he points out more than 100,000 people now have non-domicile status in Britain, most of them working in the financial markets. He reckons they will stay.
They have their jobs here, they have their homes here, they have their social life here. I simply don't believe many thousands of them will uproot themselves and move to Monaco, for example, because there's a change in their tax status.
The government is reviewing the non-domicile rule, but it's been doing that for a decade. Analysts say the government privately believes the tax break helps London maintain its status as a world city and a top financial centre. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, keeping track of your kids might save you from some hefty fines.
Parents are falsely accused of downloading music and are sued inappropriately for downloading music every day.
But first, let's do the numbers. Why, yes, it is the really happy music. The Dow Industrials rose 335 points today, 2.5% to end the day at 13,739 to mark the Fed's rate cut. The NASDAQ rose 2.7%, 70 points to close at 2651. The S&P 500 ended the day up 2.75%, 40 points at 1517. Financial stocks led the way, led by Lehman Brothers, which cranked up 10% after it released earnings today. Citigroup up 5%. Morgan Stanley, which releases earnings tomorrow, was up 5.5%. Best Buy popped up 6.5% after the retailer reported good earnings, but Smithfield Foods slipped 6% as hog prices in China fell. I'm not making this up. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here are events for Wednesday, September 19th. Disgruntled and delayed airline passengers hold a stand-in in support of the passengers' rights bill on the National Mall. The Joint Economic Committee hears testimony on the threat of subprime lending to the broader economy. And bobbing, bouncing, and clapping smiling faces, it's the 25th anniversary of email's emotional icons, a.k.a. emoticons. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
On a day when the Federal Reserve cut interest rates all over the place in response to the credit crunch, we begin our letter segment this week with your credit rating. Last week, commentator Susan Lee pointed out how something as annoying as library fines can hurt you in that regard. Chris Olson wouldn't be shushed when he heard that. Mr. Olson's the director of the library system in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and he says small fines aren't going to do any damage, but if they're bigger than that, well, you deserve what you get.
If you have hundreds of dollars of materials out and after numerous reminders to return them, you don't, well, basically you're a thief and you should not only be reported to the credit bureau, but perhaps even to the sheriff.
Libraries across the country are undoubtedly much busier now that school's back in session. We ran a series a couple of weeks ago about some of the troubles young college students are facing and how many high school seniors are looking to cheaper two-year institutions instead of traditional four-year universities. Sandra Gonzalez-Torres works at the Community College of Philadelphia. She wrote to point out junior colleges and universities aren't really two separate tracks, that students often use community colleges as a first step on the long journey to a bachelor's degree.
It may not take them 4 years. It may not be that residential experience, but they are able to complete that if they wish.
Before you can go to college, of course, you've got to get into college. Some schools are looking for new ways to get diverse student bodies using financial affirmative action as well as race-based. But Tracy Glover-Williams of Shaker Heights, Ohio, says rich minorities are still a minority.
Where are all these mythical children of African-American doctors that steal slots from more deserving white children? At my doctor's office, there is not a single black doctor in the entire practice.
Speaking of professionals, last week Cash Peters took us to the world of virtual offices, workplaces that exist purely as fronts for telecommuters. Bill Williams of Perrysburg, Ohio, says he started using a false front back in the 1970s when he was a film and television consultant, and he's kept his eye out for them since then.
In any major city, you can go into office buildings, and whenever you find a building directory that has a dozen or more different companies all with the same suite number, bingo, you've just found another virtual office.
If you have anything you'd like to say to us here at our very real office, drop us a line. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. There's yet another downloading option for music fans this week. Spiral Frog is an ad-supported site. If you can deal with the ads, you get the music free. It is limited to just one recording company, though, Universal, and the music comes with lots of restrictions on how it can be played or copied. Free doesn't always mean legal when you're downloading music, and critics say the recording industry is muddying the waters it spent years in court trying to clear up. In the second part of our special series on the music business, Marketplace's Bob Moon looks into the strategies and some of the casualties of the legal blitz that began 4 years ago this month.
Right from the start, the big music labels have had it in for file-sharing fans. This nasty scolding that Madonna unleashed in a decoy download didn't seem to work.
What the f*** do you think you're doing?
And the industry quickly escalated to a full-scale legal assault that now exceeds 20,000 lawsuits. Mitch Bainwall heads the Recording Industry Association of America.
I often run into musicians and artists who say, thank you for what you're doing. We know you take hits for this, but it's about my future, it's about my dream, and I know that our property has to be respected.
Critics counter that the big four music labels have grown into an overzealous international cartel.
As someone in the industry, it's alarming.
Former Pink Floyd manager Peter Jenner currently represents an artist coalition in London. He fears the industry is indiscriminately attacking some of its biggest fans.
It's the same way that when you see lots of civilians being killed in a war, you know that's bad for your war. And I think it's the same if you're harming individuals randomly.
No one disputes that millions around the world continue to engage in unauthorized sharing of music. But critics complain the industry is using desperation tactics that haven't solved the problem, and they charge are both legally and morally dubious. Those who find themselves in the legal crosshairs are considered by the industry guilty until they prove themselves innocent. Attorney Ray Beckerman says that doesn't allow for the real possibility that, say, parents or grandparents aren't aware of what their kids have been up to online, or that someone might be sneaking onto an unsuspecting neighbor's wireless connection.
The RIA doesn't conduct an investigation to find out whether someone committed a copyright infringement. It conducts an investigation to find out who paid the bill for an internet access account, and that's where their investigation should begin. But in their weak minds, that's where it ends.
Attorney Lori Liebeck contends that many lawsuit targets end up handing over $4,000 or $5,000 just to escape even more ruinous court battles. That includes many parents who, he says, aren't really guilty of anything.
Parents are falsely accused of downloading music and are sued inappropriately for downloading music every day.
Aren't they responsible for what their kids do?
No, the law certainly doesn't support that unless they're benefiting from it in some way.
When parents do decide to fight, he says, lawyers show no shame training their legal guns on the children. Liebeck points out the industry has sued kids as young as 12. Never mind something the head of Warner Music, Edgar Bronfman, told an interviewer.
He was being questioned as to whether his children had downloaded music, and he frankly admitted they had. But don't worry, I've had some very stern conversations with them, and they're not going to do it anymore. Which, out of fairness, a lot of parents would like to have that opportunity rather than being pestered and abused and threatened with financial ruin with a federal lawsuit.
The industry might actually be tempting youngsters and even adult fans to try out the very file-sharing sites it's battled for years to shut down. You can hear this confusion as the head of the RIAA lays out his case for us. Initially, he argues flatly that free means illegal.
The reality is almost everybody understands that the practice of taking copyrighted works for free is illegal.
But what about when the industry is giving away its own free songs?
Hey, what's happening, homie? This little won't fly, man.
This summer, a deal was announced to flood file-sharing sites with 16 million free downloads, reportedly from the popular rapper Plies.
Trouble is, fans were left guessing exactly which track would be legally free. And until the file is actually downloaded, there's no way to be sure that it's the authorized version that includes an embedded ad. Sprint pays for its logo to appear whenever the song is played. The label that's reportedly offering these free songs is one of the same companies that's been suing to discourage file sharing. Question the head of the RIAA on this haziness and listen closely. Mitch Bainwall starts making subtle exceptions.
Teenagers today understand that if you get something for free, in all probability, unless it's explicitly legal, it's not.
How's the fan supposed to know?
That's Fred Von Lohman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He complains the moving lines could lure unsuspecting fans into being sued. And it's not just the file-sharing sites that leave him confused. Some online bulletin boards also offer free MP3 music files, seemingly with the industry's blessing.
Promotional CDs get sent to these MP3 bloggers all the time, really encouraging people to post some stuff on the internet, get some buzz going. There are some independent artists who take a much more open-minded view to file sharing. Many fans have no idea whether their favorite artist is on an independent label or on a major label. This is just an area of continuing confusion.
We tried asking the industry's top representative how the average law-abiding teenager, or even his own organization, might tell the difference between what's legal and what's not. But even Mitch Bainwall didn't seem to know clearly.
There are tools in terms of authentication here, and I'm not a technician, so I really can't go into that in great detail, and I'd be happy to get you somebody who can.
Check the press release announcing those free ad-supported downloads we mentioned, and it simply says the tracks are indistinguishable from illegal pirated content. Despite this left-hand, right-hand confusion and questions about his industry's tactics, Bainwall told us he's convinced the ongoing lawsuit campaign against music fans continues to be a valuable educational tool. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, to wrap up the series, Bob explores some of the ideas being proposed to end the file-sharing standoff.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the occasion of the Fed's first interest rate cut in more than 4 years. Despite all the general rejoicing, everything's still not well in the housing sector. D.R. Horton, this country's biggest home builder, announced today it expects prices to continue to drop. The company's CFO didn't say that exactly, of course. He called it pricing pressures. On a related topic, Countrywide Financial has washed its hands of subprimes. CEO Angelo Mozzillo said at a conference this afternoon that from now on, all of its loans will be prime and prime only. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 335 points on that aforementioned interest rate cut, 2.5%. The Nasdaq spiked 70 points, 2.7%. The S&P 500 rocketed up 40 points. That is 2.75% there. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on this program, music lovers chart a new course for the industry.
I don't think we've suddenly had a massive morality shift where tens of millions of Americans who wouldn't shoplift a CD in a store have suddenly lost their moral compass.
We'll try to find it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.